Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. You know, as you know, I've been hosting this program twice a month for the past few years and have covered some pretty strange topics over those years, but the show we featured back in March generated the biggest audience response of anything that I have explored in this venue. So many of you wrote to ask that we have David Politis back to continue the conversation because even though we devoted all 4 hours to the subject the last time, we really just scratched the surface. And a lot of you wanted that program to continue. So tonight, we make good on our promise to have David back. To call this a mystery is an understatement. It's a series of events and circumstances which are truly spooky, creepy, and tragic. Inexplicable disappearances, most of them in national parks or forests, hundreds of people who simply vanish seemingly into thin air. Some of them are found, usually deceased, with strange wounds and marks on the bodies. The circumstances surrounding the searches for the missing are themselves mysterious. Bloodhounds are baffled. Veteran search and rescue teams are befuddled. A few of the victims have been found alive, but it seems like the ones who return are generally the ones who are unable to explain what happened to them, either because they're too young to speak about it, or they have mental or physical limitations which prevent them from saying much, or because they simply have blank spots in their memories. If you didn't hear the previous program, we will first cover the basics, how it happens, the circumstances surrounding these cases. And like many of you, you know, as I was first reading the books that David wrote and heard his answers in our interview, I was kind of making this mental list, my own explanations of, well, this could have happened. This is what could explain that. Kind of grasping at prosaic straws. My suggestion to you tonight as this story unfolds is you just let it unfold. Listen patiently as we lay out the facts, because while there may be some prosaic explanations for some of these cases, the overwhelming conclusion, based on the evidence, is that something truly weird is going on here, and it's still going on. Most likely in a place not that far from where you live right now, because there are cases pretty much everywhere in the country. The last time, back in March, we covered cases mostly in the western part of the U.S. and Canada. Tonight, we focus on the eastern U.S., but these incidents we're going to describe could just as easily have happened in your neck of the woods, someplace where you visited with your family or camped or hiked. David Politis wrote two volumes of his book, Missing 411, and he'll join me in just a few minutes to pick up right where we left off. So buckle up, because it's going to be a bumpy ride. Couple of other notes, and then we'll get right to it. First off, in my day job as a TV guy, I do get spoiled the kinds of stories I am assigned or allowed to cover. And the one I covered this weekend was especially cool. My photographer, Matt Adams, and I traveled to the ghost town of Goldfield, Nevada. And when I say it's a ghost town, I mean it in a literal and a figurative sense. It's an old mining town, an old gold mining town, once the biggest city in Nevada back at the turn of the century, but it struggled to hang on after the gold ran out. So it is a ghost town in many ways, but it's also a ghost town that seems to have actual ghosts, regarded by paranormal investigators as one of the most haunted places in the country, maybe the world. There's a team of these paranormal guys who have done investigations there, and they stage a dinner. They staged a dinner with ghosts inside this massive and spooky old schoolhouse in Goldfield, a place with a rich history, and much of it's tragic. I mean, if you look at the silhouette of this thing in the night sky, it looks like the house behind the Bates Motel in some ways. Anyway, they had this event. The dinner was great. The experience was wonderful, and if you're ever in that area, you might want to check this out. They hold these events once a month. It's all nonprofit, which is why I'm mentioning it. Proceeds go into a fund to help restore the old schoolhouse and eventually to help restore the town itself. A lot of fun. I'm no expert when it comes to the technology that these paranormal folks use to make contact with whatever it is they're making contact with, but it sure seemed like they made contact with something. And maybe I'll have the organizers on the program sometime in the future to talk about it. Thanks to them for inviting us to participate in this weekend event. Quick news notes. Coast listeners in the southeast, hope you're safe and dry somewhere. Tropical storm Debbie still causing havoc down there. Flooding and heavy rains reported. In Colorado, a much different emergency unfolding, still unfolding. Wildfires still raging across that state. High winds and dry conditions making things even worse. 11,000 people evacuated from their homes near Colorado Springs, and our thoughts are certainly with all of you tonight. From the Be Careful What You Wish For department, Egypt, newly democratic Egypt, has a new president tonight. He's the head of the Muslim Brotherhood Party, and he is calling tonight for unity within his country. Of course, the rest of the world wondering what that election means for the geopolitical situation, relations with Israel and the West. Guess we'll have to just wait and see and hope for the best. The host of Jeopardy, Alex Trebek, suffered a heart attack today. Don't know if you heard about this. We're told it was a mild one, that he's generally doing pretty fine. I had the pleasure of briefly meeting Mr. Trebek in New York back in May, a gentleman and a scholar, and a guy who looks in great shape. Certainly are hoping he has a speedy recovery. Webmaster Tim Binal and I have put together our usual assortment of oddities and informational bits. One of the items on the NAPS news section tonight is a TV story I produced earlier this year following the March interview with David Politis. He came to Nevada to tell my viewers here about disappearances in Nevada, strange cases. So if you want to get a basic understanding of the phenomena we'll be discussing tonight, take a look at the story. It's posted there in the NAPS news section. Also there, a weird tale about Joseph Stalin's plan to create an army of monkeys. I'm not making this up. It sounds like something out of a sci-fi movie, but it really happened. Stalin had this crazy, whacked-out idea to create an army of chimpanzees, and there's a link to a story about it. Also, 65 years ago today, the modern UFO era began when a pilot named Kenneth Arnold saw some strange objects flying over the mountains in Washington State. It set off a flying saucer furor, and created that term, flying saucer, by the way, and it continues unabated to this day. We have clips from a radio interview with Ken Arnold you might find of interest. Also there in our NAPS news section, the National Security Archives has finally squeezed out of the CIA all of its 9/11 files. Well, all of it that they're willing to release anyway. Those of you with an ongoing interest in all the events surrounding 9/11 and that tragedy will want to take a look at this compendium and study it. Few other bits and pieces there in NAPS news section on the Coast website. Take a look when you get a moment. Time now for our first break. We come right back with David Politis and Missing 411. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Dave Politis holds 2 degrees from the University of San Francisco. He has a professional background, including 20 years in law enforcement and senior executive positions in the technology sector. He had a boyhood camping experience with his father in the late 60s that sparked an interest in Bigfoot. And in 2004, he was one of the founders of the North America Bigfoot Search, where he used his investigative and analytical experiences to research Bigfoot sightings, particularly among tribal members, the Hoopa tribe in particular. He listened to and recorded their stories and wrote a book called The Hoopa Project. He was easily one of my favorite guests to talk about Bigfoot long before we started talking about the subject at hand tonight. But the work sort of intersected, and he got onto the trail of this larger mystery, and that's what he's here to talk to us about. Dave, good to have you back on the show.
Hey, thanks, George. Thanks for having me.
I want to pick up the story this way. The reaction to the interview, I mentioned in the introduction that, heck, we've got so many calls and emails. I still get them almost every day asking to have you back on, or people sending me tips about cases they're familiar with. What's it been like for you?
Equally as perplexing, the amount of email that we've received is overwhelming. I mean, the questions, the theories, the leads on other cases, it's unreal.
That's what I was kind of curious about most, is the kinds of leads, the quality of leads that you got. Are you getting stuff that you hadn't heard about before?
You know, there was a couple of unusual cases that occurred in the last just couple months, one involving a guy named Mika True who disappeared in New Mexico. He was a marathon runner, and he ran cross-country, and he disappeared in New Mexico, and nobody could find him for several days. They ended up finding him in a scenario almost identical to what I've explained. He had one or two of his shoes off. He was laying half in a creek. Initially, they didn't know why he died. He was way, way off course. The doctors, I think the autopsy said he had some type of heart issue that caused his death, but the strangeness of it is the location he was at and being found in that creek setting again.
Other kinds of reactions. What about critics? I mean, you know, because of your Bigfoot work, you must have a lot of critics in general. Have others come out of the woodwork to pounce on you?
Well, one of the more fascinating ones is that somebody took an attack stance and says, all I'm doing is picking cases out and throwing them together and making it work. And initially, I thought about this, and I went at our other team members, and I said, hey, look at this. And then we started to discuss it and said, well, that's what profiling is all about, is finding consistencies in stories, putting it together, and finding the unusual aspects of these many stories that are far too unusual to be happenstance, yet they all come together in one large conglomeration of consistency. So, in essence, the person was telling the truth, but what he didn't understand was the value in doing that.
I know that I saw and read about an invitation to speak that you had that suggests that you do have at least some credibility in the eyes of professionals.
You know, somebody got a hold of the book early on and gave a recommendation to the largest search and rescue organization in North America, and that's NASAR, National Association of Search and Rescue Professionals. They had their annual meeting in June of this year up in South Lake Tahoe. They invited me to speak. It was an absolutely packed room. Dozens and dozens of people hung around afterwards, talked to me. Probably one of the more interesting ones is there was a very senior Alaska state trooper that stood up amongst the group, and he said, you know, Dave, he said, you're saying things that we kind of all know and we've experienced before, and it's valuable to hear it from an outsider. And the other people that hung around said sort of the same things. You know, we've had these things happen to us before, but we didn't understand the magnitude of it. We thought it was just one time and gone. This is kind of perplexing and disturbing.
Well, it's a good way to get into the topic and to sort of recap where we left off. And for the benefit of those who didn't hear the earlier interview or who have not yet read your books, let's describe the scope of this thing. How many cases are we talking about?
A little over 400, and probably pushing 450, 470 right now with new leads we've got, new cases that have evolved, and us going into other areas where we haven't gone before. We kind of laid hands off on Texas and Florida and parts of Canada because it's just overwhelming. Well, we started to step into those areas and just started the forefront of looking into those cases.
I think that's probably a great disappointment to our listeners in Texas and Florida, but maybe that's a subject for a book in the future.
Yeah, it is.
Well, describe for me the parameters of this. 470 cases of what? What makes these disappearances unique? Go down the laundry list. Because, I mean, national parks, national forests, it's wilderness. So of course, people are going to get lost, disappear, never be found. That sort of comes with the territory, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think we've all been aware at some point or another when maybe we ourselves have been out there in the woods and have been lost. Not meaning you can't get back, but you're a little perplexed because you're not quite sure how to get back. You'll eventually find your way, but not right away. Well, those happen, and there's always people that are camping and they get misdirected or bad weather hits or your compass goes out and you get lost. But no, these are different. The first one I'll talk about is missing kids. Children, say, under the age of 8, 7, 6 years old that disappear, we should be finding 100% of those kids. And when you talk to search and rescue people, I think they would agree that we should be finding those kids with the amount of effort that's exerted. And one thing we have to all remember is that a child 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, they don't want to get lost. They're not looking to run away. They're not looking to commit suicide. These are children that are fairly innocent and are very innocent in life and have somehow or another gotten away from their guardians to the point that a massive search starts. And these are some of the biggest searches in U.S. history, and they find nothing. And I mean, they bring in canines, and the canines can't find a scent.
And that's one of the characteristics, right? Why don't you elaborate on that?
So some of the dogs obviously some dogs maybe aren't having a good day or they don't feel well or whatever it might be. But no, dog after dog after breed, they just can't find the scent. Sometimes they walk in circles. Sometimes they lay down. Other times they'll walk up the trail 100 yards and just lay down. And sometimes they show no interest, but other times it's almost they're ambivalent. They don't care. They don't want anything to do with it, and they shun it. And in fact, when I was at the conference, I talked about that, and a couple of guys came up and said, yeah, you know, we've seen this a few rare times, and we couldn't explain why it was happening.
And well, it's very unusual for these kind of animals because that's what they live for. They're trained for it. They can't wait to get out there and track something down, right?
Oh, absolutely. They get excited for this. This is you hit it. This is what they live for. Exactly.
And how often does that happen? I mean, dozens, scores?
I would say probably several hundred. I mean, that's a fairly consistent part of what we've mapped out here. Because if the dogs were able to get a scent, they're usually able to find the person or the body. And then even taking this one step further, you go forward, say, 3-4 weeks or after a snow melt, and they bring in cadaver dogs. They're an entirely different aspect. They're looking for a different scent. And again, those dogs can't find anything either.
You mentioned that the kids should be found. I mean, one factor in that is they're young kids. They can only go so far. They should be somewhere in the vicinity of where they disappeared.
And here we step into another area. So search and rescue people work off, say, percentages. They have books that they refer to, okay? A child on a flat level surface, say a desert, under the age of five, between 3 and 5, it can be found 95% of the time in 1.5 miles or less. Let's just say that's it. Well, then they'll throw their search grids out to 1.25 miles because they know that'll cover 98% of the time. They'll find something. Well, in these cases, not only are the kids sometimes, if they are found, are so far out beyond belief that it absolutely throws everything into a kilter, or a child disappears and they're found thousands of feet up in the mountains, so far beyond what is reasonable or rational for any search pattern or an adult, that it doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, there's a case on the eastern side of Yosemite that I talk about. Kid was 2.5 years old. He went up 3,000 feet, almost straight up a mountain, and they found him nearly naked behind a boulder, dead. Another kid in Oregon that we talked about last time, kid was found, he was two and a half years old. He was found 12 miles and two mountain rangers and two fence lines away from his grandparents' farm. Completely baffling.
So there's no logical way that kids of that age, that physical capability, should be able to climb something that high and difficult or travel over that kind of a distance in a short period of time.
I don't believe that would be a rational thought, no.
You mentioned about the dogs. Another factor that has popped up in these cases is clothing. Weird things happen to clothing. Talk about that in general.
And in fact, I heard many, many emails talking about hypothermia and people shedding clothing when they get hypothermic. And there's a few people who propagandize that theory that when hikers and things develop a later stage of hypothermia, that they'll shed the clothing. And it's opposite in thought and opposite in rational thought, but that's one of the reasons why these people are doing it. I say, okay, but I cite many cases in the books, where somebody disappears from a rural location, and within 100 yards, clothes are coming off. And a vast majority of the time, it's shoes, sometimes it's coats, other times it's small children, and when they're brought back to the parent says, well, something very strange has happened here, and we want the police involved because my child can't undress themselves. And I've heard that many, many times. So I don't think that the hypothermia aspect about shedding clothing is rational in a vast majority of the cases because the distances, what the parents say, et cetera, does not make any sense.
And you've got some cases where the clothes are, the body's not found, or maybe the body is found, and the clothes are sort of neatly folded, like somebody was doing the laundry.
Yes, and that is really strange, especially when the child may be very young.
And then I want to get into a discussion about the wounds, the injuries that are found on the bodies, because that gets into some very strange territory. We continue our conversation with Dave Politis, author of Missing 411, right after this. We're talking with Dave Politis, author of the dual volume book Missing 411, about strange disappearances inside our national parks and national forests. Why parks? Why forests? Is it connection to trees or what? And when you hear about some of the injuries that are found on these bodies, the wounds that are found, it's not like the kind of thing you would expect from a wild animal attack. It's just very strange. We pick up the conversation right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Dave, why national forests and national parks? I mean, is it just the presence of trees or the fact that it's wilderness? I mean, as I mentioned before, it makes sense that people disappear in wilderness, but why is it focused on these kinds of lands?
Well, those are good questions. And trying to get data out of the Park Service to understand the elements that may be involved has been perplexing at best. And we filed a series of Freedom of Information Act requests against the Park Service, trying to get numbers out of them to understand how deep this issue may go. And the Park Service hasn't allowed us to get those numbers, and in fact has said that they don't keep track of missing people inside their system. They said that they rely on the institutional memory of their employees. So then we came back and we said, well, okay, using that institutional memory, give us a list going back 60 years. And they said, well, no, we're going to have to hand search that, and that's going to take quite a while. And by the way, it's going to cost you, just for Yosemite National Park, $34,000. And then I said, well, let's try it one more further. How about from all 380-plus of your institutions? Let's see the numbers of missing people from there. They said that'd be $1.4 million. And then they reiterated that they don't have any lists. They don't keep track of missing people. They don't know how many missing people they have. And when you think about this rationally, there isn't a police department of any size in the U.S. where their chief would come out and make such a statement about missing people inside their system. You know, in a day and an age where accountability is number one in law enforcement, for the National Park Service law enforcement officers and their administration to say that is abominable.
For example, Yosemite. Now, a lot of people, as you've mentioned in the first volume of your book, a lot of people have disappeared in Yosemite. How many, we don't exactly know, because the Park Service, which runs the place, says it doesn't keep a list. I mean, you're a former lawman. How outrageous and ridiculous is that position?
I honestly don't believe that a chief could keep their job in any city if they came out and made a statement like that. It's beyond belief. And so what we did with that is we just dove headfirst into an unbelievable archive search, and we came up with some information that even makes their statement more disturbing. I won't go into names and such, but in the 1950s, there were two guys who disappeared in Yosemite 4 months apart. They both went to UC Berkeley. They were both grad students. They didn't know each other. And they were with their families at different times vacationing in Yosemite. They both disappeared. They were both never found. It just so happened that the parents found each other, and they wrote a letter to President Eisenhower, and they said, you know, it was a fluke that we found each other. Our kids are outstanding people, smart individuals. They went for a little hike, and they never came back. We both feel that both of our children were abducted. We don't think enough's being done about it, and this is in their letter. They want special forces to come in and search for their kids. And Eisenhower never responded. And I find that perplexing as well.
I should say, from a matter of personal experience, after we interviewed you back in March, I got curious about how the Park Service in sort of my neck of the woods might respond. So I filed some FOIA requests for disappearances in national forests and similar places here in Nevada. And I got the same response. They said they don't keep the list. They looked and looked and looked and said, we don't keep a list. If you've got information on a specific case, if you already have the name, we'll look it up for you. But if you don't have the name, we're not going to give it to you. Is that similar? Yeah. That's the same response you've been getting.
Absolutely. And even if we come up with names, that's no guarantee we're going to get the documents. We asked for a series of documents out of Crater Lake National Park, and they said that they didn't have room to archive this information. This was, I think, from 78, 79. They said that they didn't have room, and they got rid of all the documents, and they couldn't find them. And this was like a series of 10 or 12-year span. I mean, it did a FOIA request on a girl, a 14-year-old girl, disappeared from Yosemite named Stacy Arras, who lived in Saratoga, a town right next to me. And this is after the Park Service has given us probably 25, 35 cases of active missing persons cases and their reports and the data and everything under FOIA. And on the Arras case, which is classified as a missing persons case, they said that they wouldn't give us the document. And when we asked why, they said that that would compromise any possible charges that may be filed in the future. And this was a 1981 case, I believe. And a majority of the people involved that were there when this happened are dead. And so I got a call from an investigator and said, well, Dave, why do you want this case? I said, well, under FOIA, you can't even ask me that question. That can't be in the decision-making process according to law. And I said, but we're a missing persons group, and we're just investigating disappearances. This is an unusual disappearance where nothing is found of this girl. And he goes, well, you're never going to get this case. I said, well, are there any suspects? No. I said, has there been any investigation in the last 15 years? No. I said, are there any leads? No. I said, how's it classified? Missing persons case. I said, so there's no criminal elements? No. I said, then why not release it? He goes, you're never going to get it. And we filed a series of appeals, one through the National Park Service that was routinely denied. And then I actually went to my congressman here in San Jose. He followed it up, and he was denied.
Whoa. I should remind the listeners that you got started on this trail through a tip from somebody who worked for one of these agencies, right?
Correct.
Tell that story.
So I was in a national park doing some other research, and I was... A lot of times you don't get the information you're looking for talking to national park employees. Many times you have to talk to the concessionaires and the people that are working on the park that aren't exactly working for the government, but they're working on contract groups on the park because they hear the same things, but they're not under the same no-talk clause maybe that a Park Service employee is. So I was talking to them, and there were a series of Park Service people following me around, kind of listening, looking what I was doing. They were polite, and I was staying outside the park. And late that night, not late, but in the dark hours, somebody knocks at the door. Person comes in and says, hey, you know, I'm so-and-so from the Park Service, and I saw you on the park today, and I saw you asking questions, and myself and another person did a little research, and we know you're an ex-cop, written a few books, and I know that you'll really do the job if we give you some information. They stated that they had worked at a few other parks, and they had noticed a consistent trend with the Park Service that when someone initially goes missing, there's a lot of publicity, there's a lot of people looking at the case, there's a lot of effort going into that initial 1 week or so search, and they said then everything stops. There's really no follow-up, there's really no other searches, and really it just goes away in their minds. And they said, but the more disturbing thing is that in their minds, there were way, way too many people disappearing under unusual circumstances, and it sometimes in the same general areas of the parks that they worked in, and they couldn't fathom why this was occurring. But they were concerned because the Park Service, they didn't think, was really doing their job as much as they should be. And they said, you know, I think this is worth looking at, Dave. And so the next day, I called a couple guys before I was coming home. I said, hey, look this up and see if you can do some archives and see if there's something here. And bam, right away we saw some things that just are disturbing. And it goes back to the Stacy Arras case. But then I wrote about some cases out of Yosemite that are just mind-blowing. I mean, right away you say, this can't be normal. This can't be right. You know, why don't we hear about this? Why isn't the public made aware? Why doesn't the news services in these cities adjacent to these parks publicize these cases?
Well, I guess one reason is, you know, the Park Service will post a missing persons case on a website. They'll put something out, leave it online for a while. But there's no attempt to draw a connection to similar cases. There's no ongoing list. There's no sort of red flag to alert media folks that, hey, this is not just one case. It's a lot of cases, and it's been going on a long time.
And therein lies part of the issue. I think in some ways, there maybe should be an outside agency, not federal. Maybe it should go to the county sheriff, or it should go to the state police in that jurisdiction to handle the investigation, because there's almost a conflict of interest by having the Park Service research issues inside their park. If, say, there happened to be a linkage amongst all these missing people, or let's say there was a linkage between a series of homicides, that goes against what they really want, and that is more people in the park.
Well, I mean, you know, you can't blame them. They don't want to scare people away from visiting a national park. You don't either.
No, I think that there's an understanding there that they need the people visiting, but I also believe that people need to make an educated decision about where and when they visit, and they need to understand the complexities of what happens there when you don't watch your children, say. And just because you're in a national forest, that isn't a place that's to let your kids roam free, to walk with a complete feeling of freedom and safety, because that's far from true.
You know, one of the things that sort of sticks in my head from reading the books and then talking to you about some of the cases here in Nevada is that even attentive parents, you know, they're watching their kids pretty well. Their kids can disappear right under their noses, or somebody who's an experienced hiker or experienced woodsman is with a group of people, and they vanish seemingly into thin air while they're surrounded by other people.
And that seems to be something that is loosely one of those elements. If you're at the end of a line of people or an end of a line of bike riders or something similar to that, it seems like it's the last one that disappears. Or a person who's in the front of the line and not with the group walks in front of everybody. They lose sight of them momentarily. Boom, they're gone. And like you said, a dad could be watching their son play hide-and-seek on a grassy lawn, step behind a bush playing hide-and-seek, and 50 seconds to a minute later, that kid's gone and he's never found again.
Or if he's found, it's miles and miles away, well beyond the area that any normal search and rescue perimeter would be set up.
Correct.
Talk to me about injuries. Because give me some examples, the kinds of injuries and wounds that are found on bodies that are just sort of out of bounds.
Very perplexing. There's, as you and I walk through the woods, we try to find the path, if we're not on a noted trail, we try to find the path of least resistance, meaning we're not going to walk into a branch if we don't have to. We're not going to walk into a rock fall area if we don't have to. Many times, the people, when they're found, are found with scratches on their bodies from head to toe. And sometimes these they're called lacerations sometimes scratches, and sometimes they're considered to be torn. And in the articles, it says there were giant tears on the body as though the person was running and just indiscriminately ripping their body and skin apart on thorns and branches and things in the area. Now, that's a hypothesis by the writer, because they truly don't know, because the person's usually dead. And if the person is alive, like you stated earlier, sometimes the person can't speak because they're too young, or another element is that the person can't speak because they have a disability. And this is a real unusual element that we found that doesn't make any sense. And the person could have a disability in the sense that their specific speech is impaired. They could have a disability where they just have never been able to communicate. Or, like I said earlier, they could be the type, say, a kid under 2 years old that just cannot speak, period. They haven't learned to speak. And then the adults that are found, sometimes when they ask them what happened, the person just blanks. I don't really know. I remember walking here, and after that, I don't remember anything.
Considering some of the injuries, I mean, you could have somebody say, well, that had to be a bear, and this guy was eaten. I mean, you do have cases where it looks like the person who vanished was eaten, right?
Absolutely. And there's a story I write about in the Western book. A guy named Bart Schleyer disappeared in the Yukon Territory. And this man was a mountain man to the max, very well educated, knew the woods better than probably anybody in the world, was a bear expert, and he was moose hunting with a bow and arrow, disappeared. RCMP initially didn't really do a good investigation. His friends went in, and they did a better one, forced the RCMP to go back in. I interviewed one of the conservation officers that was on that scene, and he said, "Dave, how did you pick the one case in 33 years that we cannot figure out what happened?" And what it was is that they went in and they found bear scat in there, in the area, and they took samples, but there was no human remains in the scat, and there was no clothing in the scat. They found his pants turned inside out at the scene, but there were no bite marks in any of his clothing. He was consumed by something, but it wasn't a bear. And the conservation officer said, "Bears in the Yukon do not consume people. They may kill you. They may bite you and chew you up a little bit, but they don't consume you in total like Bart Schleyer's case." I asked him, I said, "What consumed him?" He said, "God only knows." He says it was something unbelievably strong and fast. Because this guy...
Do you have any teeth marks or claw marks that could identifiable? I mean, it sounds like some of these could be bears.
And that's the assumption, if you're in bear territory, that this is what's done it. But there's a couple of clues. The pants inside out with no bite marks in them. Clothing found at the scene that should have bite marks in it or torn to shreds. When bears consume somebody or something, they stay on site or they drag it away, and they'll come back and they'll consume it more. But in those areas, they'll find scat with human remains or with clothing in it. They don't find those things. And when they find these people, sometimes there's so few remains found that it's baffling. Maybe they find just the top of the cranium, and that's it. And maybe they find infinitesimal-sized pieces of bones that really are tough to ID as a body part other than their bones. There's a case out of the Crater Lake area again where a couple of rangers went in. I interviewed one of them, said the same thing that the guy said from the Yukon. "You picked the one case in 30 years I can't explain." Said that the in the middle of the wilderness, they find this guy dead, pieces of bones just like I explained. They knew it wasn't a scene where a bear had taken the guy because they find this guy's pants as though you and I were standing up and we dropped our pants straight onto the floor and we died. And in the socks, they found bones. In the right pant leg, they found a broken right tibia. That's the shin bone. But the unusual part of this is the pants were unbuckled and the belt was unbuckled and the zipper was down. Yet the pants weren't chewed up. There's no holes. There's no anything. They found his backpack. They found some other items that should have been all chewed up. There was food in the backpack that wasn't touched. It doesn't make any sense.
I guess for those cases where somebody is hiking with other people, a bear attack doesn't cut it because you'd hear a bear or you'd see evidence on the ground. There'd be blood or signs of a struggle, tracks, things of that sort.
Well, the biggest thing is you'd hear the guy screaming, right?
Yeah.
There'd be a fight. There'd be a scene there with, you know, clothing and blood and obviously something that once you brought in a dog, the dog could for sure track this and find it. And usually these bears in these areas are not huge bears. We're talking bears maybe 200 pounds, the biggest one, where if they tried to take an adult, that'd be a pretty big fight.
Dave Politis talking to us about these mysterious disappearances in national parks and forests. We continue the conversation, look at a couple of other characteristics, and then get into the eastern states cases right after this.